By the way, I couldn't hear you on the headset. Say amen.
You were just live there.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille in with you with the Positive Mind. Unusual time, unusual day here at WBAI 99.5. Usually with you Tuesdays and most Wednesdays. Today we're here as part of a special. And it's our special because we're fundraising, raising money for the summer. But in these programs, we prepare special programs for you to kind of let you know how serious we are about our work. Today, we're looking at risk itself. Risk. You know? I asked somebody, what did they think about risk? And they said, oh, I don't even wear a watch anymore. You know, people don't wear wristwatches anymore. They don't. They look at their cell phone. Risk. R-A-S-K. Let's look at risk itself as a mental state that often changes with age. The obvious truth, babies do not risk. You know, a baby doesn't take risks. You've got in the studio with me, Ken Robertshaw. When those babies came out, right, there was no risk for them because they didn't know, they wouldn't know danger.
That's right. They don't know danger at that point. They're just doing what feels right, what feels natural. And
they're not filled with anxieties and fears about doing things different or unfamiliar.
Right, but then they find out there is danger. They touch a fire, they fall off a crib, they do something. And there gets this look that goes over the baby's face about whether they should take the risk or not. Do you see such a thing, or am I making that up?
No,
I got Linda standing here too, another baby master.
Yeah, absolutely. There's clearly things that they experience, things they taste, and fire and hazards and the like that they realize and get connected with something they're not going to want to do again.
And then they even have some things that are not dangerous that they associate to danger or a bad feeling, and they don't want to do that either.
Right.
Like what? Like you offer them... Like what? What kind of thing do you offer a child that they flatly refuse to do, even though you know it's good for the child?
Vegetables. Certain foods and the like, absolutely.
And there's associations between them. If it looks like pasta, they'll eat it. You know, if it looks like something, they'll give it a try. But they're also quick to reject stuff, right? Take it out of their mouth. Nah.
Right.
I don't like that. Babies. But as we get older, we look at risk. Babies begin to risk. They begin to know danger. For example, they know the danger of not being within their parents' earshot, right? And we always wonder how babies develop. How do they separate from their parents? And if you ever go to a swimming pool, a public swimming pool or a private swimming pool, in the summer, you'll learn the exact technique. They learn how to scream. Babies like to scream in pools. If you're somebody who likes to sit around a pool but you want peace and quiet, go down to Florida. Because if you're going to be up here in New York, if you're going to be around this area, people bring their babies. And what do babies do? They scream. And why do babies scream? Because they're training their parents to their voice. You see, this is what every animal, penguins do the same thing. They have a sound. If a penguin gets on land and has 100,000 penguins all around, the parent will recognize that voice. So that tonsillating, that vibration, that scream, even though it seems over nothing, is really practicing to be safe in the world by knowing that you have the tools to call for safety. So then you always have the parent who is telling the kid, don't scream, right? The parent tells the kid, don't scream. We get angry at the parent for having the kid scream. The kid is screaming, but it doesn't really know why. So it tries. Then it becomes afraid to scream. Without that scream, the child develops other fears. Now I can't contact them as fast as possible. Maybe I better keep my eyes on them. And they wind up being better watchers, you know, more visual, more audio, all accordingly to how it's going to develop as risk develops as you're a child. Now, risk starts when you perceive danger. And what is danger? Danger is a threat to you or yours in some way. What is danger? It could be an occasional, an ocean wave, or it could be a tsunami. You're the one who watches. You see, you hear, you sense. They gave you five senses to see if you could tell if danger is coming. With that, if you're sharp at being able to perceive danger, you get by a lot easier. But if risk is perceived, potential danger mixed with action, in spite of this, like, let's use an example of it, falling in love. You fall in love with someone you know is not good for you. So what, he's got tattoos. So what, he's been in prison. So what, he's on a motorcycle. So what, he carries a knife and a gun and has the best drugs, but he's different from me. See, risk. Or you admit to yourself, I love the risk. I love the fact that he could kill me. I love the danger. There's a part of our body, sometimes, when we're depressed, that welcomes risk. And I think that's why you see so many depressed people love horror movies. They love the horror movies. You know, you go to a horror movie, and it's like if you ask depressed people what kind of movies they like, they very often say horror movies. You know, because it kind of lifts you. What does it do to you, Kent? What's the... Well, again, what's the chemistry of it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of risky behavior is involved with getting the dopamine system energized. The dopamine.
A lot of people don't know what the dopamine system is. Is that what you get at the candy counter?
No.
Can you walk in and say, I'll take a little dopamine and
buy a little
on my butter?
You know, the brain chemistry uses lots of different neurotransmitters, lots of chemicals to talk to each other. You know, the famous serotonin medication, neurotransmitters that are involved with antidepressants. But one of the major elements in the brain that's used to reward behavior and is stimulated with exciting, novel behavior is dopamine. And so that doing things that are very safe and familiar will have a very sluggish dopamine, but doing a risky behavior, doing something interesting that's novel and something that's fearful. So lots of risk, there's a little fear attached, and obviously a horror movie or a frightening movie, you're putting yourself in a situation where you're kind of pretending to get frightened in a way, in a safe environment, and yet that's very much stimulating the dopamine center when you're there in your living room in the theater.
It's like the roller coaster.
Right.
It's like the roller coaster. Risk is trying something strange, like a food you never tasted, but you know somebody else is eating it. Right? Sometimes I watch those programs where they have unmentionable foods.
Mm-hmm. You know, fried ants or something.
Yes. How do they do it? Yeah. How do they do it? Or Aunt Sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Risk is meeting strangers. You know, you put yourself out there in the world, that's risk as well. But we all take risks on a daily basis, so risk comes in what I call three forms. Here are my three forms of risk. The daily barely risks. Daily barely risks. That's something you do like flying in a plane, walking down the street. These are things you do every day. But it's barely a risk because you do it every day, and the odds of getting in danger are very little. Then there's a thrill risk. The risk for the sake of the rush, the roller coaster, the dopamine, the falling in love. These are kind of voluntary risks where you keep the danger in the back of your brain, not in the forebrain, and you take this chance and you feel the thrill of danger. And then there's the dangerous risks, the ones from which there can be a profound loss, like doing something really illegal, like stealing, like breaking and entering, like criminal behaviors. I put at the top of it, did you think of any others? What are the really, really dangerous? Oh, mixing our chemicals. right? Some of the real dangerous ones. Because people want to kill themselves, you know?
Right, some drug cocktails or something, mixing various illegal drugs or things with alcohol to get a high, but something that you could potentially Heath Ledger, Michael Jackson, unintentionally overdose.
Or even that strangulation sex, right? Where you hang yourself from a roof or whatever you do while you're...
David Carradine, I think, yes.
David recently. Carradine. Well, in these kind of risks, Kent, what's the most common cocktail to create a possible, what would it create, a heart attack? What would it go, what does it knock out the heart?
Oh, yeah, it could, be a combination, particularly with things like amphetamines and cocaine that are accelerants that could cause a heart attack. The other kinds of things that was, resulted in Heath Ledger and Michael Jackson die were all these sedating sorts of combinations that cause the heart and the brain and the respiratory system to slow down to the point where the person stops breathing.
So you could either you could get so hyped up, or you could slow yourself down, or you could meditate probably to death.
Right.
You probably could do that too. You know, they had the monks who could not breathe air in a small space for a number of days. All right. Dangerous risks. Risk that you take because you know the danger. Give me that acid, right? I remember, take a tab of acid. Take two tabs of acid. Here's three tabs of acid, and you got the Doors. You remember the Doors, the movie? It's a good, good, good example of living life at the edge. Now, isn't it amazing that voluntary risk seems to correlate with your physical and emotional well-being and your perceived level of vulnerability? What you perceive as your level of vulnerability. So I asked a young man before, and he said to me, I can afford to take those chances. I'm young. I can eat what I want to eat. I'm young. Because he's right. He's less vulnerable now. He's not vulnerable now. He's a titan. Right? He's somebody who could be out there doing whatever he wants to do. The consequences are minuscule, even though we old farts will say, that new legal word, will say, you're not allowed to do it. Oral force says, you're not allowed to do it. You shouldn't do it. It's dangerous for you. See, if you smoke a cigarette, you're going to get cancer. If you do this, you're going to do that. If you do have unprotected sex, right, you're going to wind up getting leprosy. But if you're young and fit and healthy, the correlation is, you believe you can take more risks. Now, we know a lot of young, healthy, fit people who are phobic, who live their lives fearing everything, like obsessive-compulsive disorders. Isn't that based on fear?
Yeah, often irrational, crazy worries and anxieties about the consequence. Again, the classic step on a crack, break my mother's back. For some weird reason, the brain chemistry is such that they fear that something bad would happen, even though the logical part of the brain understands that it can't be correlated, but they can't shake it.
And I gotta check. You know, what is checking? Describe what checking is related to fear.
Well, again, it's even though I've understood that I've turned off the oven and I've locked the door once or twice, I remember clearly there becomes this doubting thought in my head, this worry, this fear that maybe I didn't do it right, even though I've done it several times. So an OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, checking phenomena would be people again and again, whether it's their alarm clock, their stoves, their locks on the door, again and again, even though they know they've looked at it several times, this creeping fear comes up that maybe they did it wrong. Maybe the gas is still on the stove. Maybe they didn't really lock the front door.
And the risk would be walking out without checking the locks, right? The risk. And the risk is that if you didn't lock your door, something's going to happen.
Right.
If you don't overwash your hands, you're going to pick up something dirty and touch it. And it's going to touch you and give you a disease. If you don't shut off the stove, the house is going to blow up. These are the kind of built-in fears that frequently make a person stop taking risks. Like if a person has a fear of crowds, right? They're not going to be, they're not going to accept invitations. They may not travel. I know a man who, if you ask him, you know, he doesn't like to travel. So what he does is he, when since all of his friends, and he's 60 years old, all of his friends go to him and tell him about the great trips they took. And they say, you should go there. And he says, I don't have to go there. I just was there yesterday on the television. I watched the Discovery Channel. And he has this phrase that he keeps saying over and over again. I saw it. I was on the Discovery Channel. I saw it. It's almost like he's prepared to defend himself against the onslaught of people. The second thing he's got is he's got a dog that's very temperamental. And if he leaves the dog for more than 3 hours, the dog has a fit in the house. So the other thing he says is, I can't leave because of the dog. Now, he's a very nice man, but he has these things that keep him trapped in one place. And what is it? It's the absence of risk. The absence of risk. It's this thing that he just refuses to take any chances. And luckily, he's got gin to keep him in one space. Because that's another thing about alcoholism, is it limits risk. It limits your need for risk. Just makes you stay in one place. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Wherever you are and whatever you're doing, just hang in there. It's by Pink Martini. You know Pink Martini. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We talk with great heart here because we have great heart here. It's just terrific people all around. Around here, around WBAI, these are people who are very special, and keeping this program alive is amazing. We want to thank you, and we want you to make your calls, but I want to go back to this program and hear about risk. Now, we're talking about risk and what happens to risk as you get older. People have a kind of a prejudice as they get older, as we become more fragile. You see, there are risks you can prepare for, right? You have a dog, it's 17 years old. You know it's going to die. You know you're going to survive. You have a child who dies. Whew. You never do survive. Right? You have a parent who dies, you survive. Husband and wife, maybe, maybe not, according to how you were able to take care of yourself during the time you were together. So survival and risk is very important. So if you're husband wants to go skydiving, you say, no, you're not. No, you're not. Not because of you, but because of me. I'm afraid to lose you. But then you lost him. See, number one, if he wants to go skydiving, you probably lost him. And number two, if you inhibit his want desire to go, it's probably lost him. So it's time to have other talks. Time to go see a therapist. Hey, as we become more fragile, more dependent, more vulnerable, more dependent, you got to lean on somebody else to be there. I don't want to go alone. More vulnerable, we tend to naturally to risk less. You walk differently. Do you ever see the shuffle that old people shuffle? Right? They're just being careful. Shuffle along the ground. Right? Even if your body's in tip-top shape, let's say you're a Gary Null guy, right? And you have true amazing, some of his friends and group around him. You could look at them, age 65, perfect, mean machines. Lean, mean, perfect, absolutely keeping it all in shape. Even if you're older and you're in perfect shape, you're still vulnerable to the prejudices that people have about age. So less selective mating. You know, a young woman looks at you and she says, you're not the best mating material because nature told her to get somebody around her own age. So you get less selection of the beauties. You get less invitations to things. Because people think, you know, well, we're going to have all teenagers here. Do we want that 50-year-old here? No. You know, just their very presence represents death. You have less sex. Because part of you, it dies down. The urge dies down a little bit. You know, part of menopause may actually take away some of the pleasure of it. It's less available, less of it. And the way the world works, who cares? You have less mobility. Can't pick up and go as fast as you'd like to and where you can travel to. But if you're not in top shape, you have to be afraid of falling. This is a funny thing, because one of the things that they studied about humans, do you ever notice when humans are falling asleep, that very often if they're falling out of bed, they make a grasping motion with their hands. They're grabbing as if they're grabbing in the air, that motion. Do you ever see that happens to people when they're falling? Well, they looked at that behavior and they said, where does that behavior, well, why, what is it? And they equated it to the chimps who would be grabbing on branches should they fall off a branch. Because falling was the big danger back then in our primordial ancestry. And then isn't it funny that it turns out that as you get older and more fragile, falling is the danger. So they give you grab bars to make up for it. Life works. But if you get to a point where you get so fragile that you over-focus on the, you begin to watch TV and you try to make, you watch everything on television, you watch Oprah, you watch The View, you watch all these programs, or you focus on the grandchildren. No, first of all, you try to make the children guilty for not visiting you. This is a piece of work that you very often might do. You get older, and then you need company. How are you, Grandma? I'm fine. I can't open this jar. Okay. All right. Yes, well, then you just keep advising your grandmother. But somehow their job is to install guilt in their children. In your mother's family has to instill guilt in you so that you still want to visit on a once-a-week basis, once-a-month basis, call my mother every day basis, even if she is miserable and sounds sour. I knew one guy whose mother was so sour that every time she got on the phone, he said, if you complain, I'm hanging up the phone. And she said, how could you do such a thing? He said, that's a complaint, so he hung up the phone. Now, he called his two sisters and said to them, this is what I'm doing. I'm tired of having Mom get on the phone with all her complaints, because they just keep going. So he asked his two sisters, would you please do it too? So then when she would call, and she would call one of the sisters, they would say, Ma, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I got to hang up the phone if you complain. We just figure it's a plan. The three of us are going to do it. Please, how could you do such a... Boom, hung up the phone. Well, the funny thing happened with the mother. Her physical health improved significantly. She not only didn't talk about it, she didn't become it because it was not reinforced. If you reinforce illness, you get illness. Hey, Mom, come out to dinner. I don't want to go out. Let's sit and have something here. Come on out, Mom. Well, if you don't want to come out, I want to be out, so I'll have dinner alone. Now, that's one of the things you do because you want to help this person. You see, you want to help them keep their spirit going because the tendency is to close down. Now, there's nothing wrong with closing down. There's nothing wrong with eliminating risk because you may just be prepared to die. And dying's not so bad. If you're 70 years old and everything aches and nobody really cares or invites you to things and you don't have as many friends, and you have aches and pains all over, maybe you want to die. They don't let you do it. But maybe you just say, I'm going to stay here and watch television and eat takeout food and just, you know, when the time comes. No, not takeout, leftovers, wrapped up. When the time comes, I'll just, why don't they just let me go? Okay, you're right. But maybe selfish us don't want to see them waste away. We want those elders. I'll tell you what I think about the elders. I think they owe us something. I think, even though I'm an elder, but if you're paying Social Security, that Social Security goes into Medicare, and that Medicare is keeping me alive much longer than you even thought I would, so you have to work for me. Therefore, I, the elder, should work for you. And I think retirees and parents should have to take more risks. I think they have to get up there and start doing some work. They got to go out there and help out wherever they can. I don't care if they're cleaning houses. I don't care what they do. Dust the blinds. You know, if you can't lift your arms and you can't lift your legs, find a way of getting mobility. Get out there. If you're somebody who speaks a language, there are hundreds of thousands of children who can't afford school. Find a place where you could deliver some of those services. I think it's your job. I think you owe it. So I think a lot of elders like to focus on pets, you know, especially little face-licking, cuddly dogs that you could sleep with, or a big dog that saves, that scares everybody. That's another kind of relationship that keeps you in the house. It just keeps you there unless that dog really takes you out for a walk, which some dogs do. And when people invite you out to stay, you say things like, I have to get back to the dog. So obviously, the older you get, the more risk avoidant you get. Okay, so now, for a minute, let's go back to the beginning. All risk is not good. If you've lived in a freewheeling 1970s, hippie lifestyle, you did not prepare well for your later age. You didn't. Unless you took a job at Apple, right? By accident, a little company called Apple, and they have a couple of jobs open, but you don't have to show you can wear a T-shirt, right? Then you're fine. You're one of those who wound up doing okay. But if you showed risk and you rejected the white-collar worker and you just said, no, I'm not going to be a slave to the man, well, a lot of people did that, and you wound up with, I'm going to have the good time I want. 50% of the people in the world have herpes. That means somebody's sowing their oats without all the care. STDs of all kinds, unwanted pregnancies. Bad news, but goes with the territory of a freewheeling lifestyle. What was that statistic, Kent, you just read about the same-sex marriages?
Well, that one of the risky behaviors, thrill seeking, the category you talked about, is having affairs, is straying outside of a relationship as one of the things that provides a thrill. If your life is, if you have depression or your relationships become boring and like, but most people have a prohibition against that, and apparently in homosexual relationships, that over 50% of those relationships, they allow some amount of relationship, sexual relationship outside of the relationship, that you're allowed to have that thrill. It's all about thrill seeking, to have different and new novel sexual behavior outside of the loving marriage you're in, whereas less than 10% of the heterosexual population is it allowed. That's not to say that it doesn't happen with Spitzer and Wiener at all, but it's not at all accepted. It's not agreed upon.
It's one of those little battles that we like to produce in our heads, only here in the United States. Now, I remember what your... Linda, you had a story about your grandfather, right?
Yes, I do, Armand. But just one thing I just want to remark on what Kent just said. I just wonder when things are allowed and if it's as much a risk as when it's not allowed. I think that's
right,
kind of
thrill could be something instead
thrill,
of risk,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And well, what I was mentioning to you earlier when we were discussing aging and dependency upon grandchildren or children to visit, it brought me to a relationship or a story within my own family of my grandparents, both from Spain, who, when they retired, when my grandfather retired, he said, well, if I stay here, all I'm going to be doing is taking care of grandchildren and watching television. So he decided to return to Spain, where he had a house and orchard and, of course, maintained very much an active life of walking and therefore lived till he was 93 and very healthy, and my grandmother passed at 105. So for them, their golden years were truly golden, where they were able to maintain a social life of with people their own age, and the walking and the interest and the socializing and the teaching each other, exchanging of languages and games. Newspapers, current events really became, in my experience, quite a role model for me when I look at it and think, oh, that's a nice way to grow old.
I wonder about relocating. You know, relocating, there are so many physicians I know who talk about people who have got bronchial disorders or some kind of, and he said, what do you get out of New York? Get somewhere where it's dry, don't go through this cold winter, go somewhere else, be somewhere else, and people don't think of doing it. People think they can't relocate at this age. So I wonder, it may be true. Maybe you can't. Maybe without your roots, you can't make it. But maybe you can. And maybe you can is a very interesting thing. You know, maybe if you just got on a life raft and just decided to paddle out, maybe there'd be an adventure of a lifetime. And maybe it'll only shorten your life by 10 years. But it sounds like it might be a little better than just waiting to die. So these are the way that you see risk and the way you handle risk is very important for, for your future. Risk is, let me see, risk. Hey, my friends. This is Armando Mowati. What do you think, Kent?
Well, I think that, again, that a lot of people, risk involves a potential to have danger, a potential to fail at something, to risk to do something that's not in your comfort zone. There's always the idea that not only something bad may happen, but more importantly, I'm not going to be successful at it. If I start taking tango lessons at my age, you know, that I may be horrible or something. But it's all about sort of taking these risks with the idea that you know there's some danger, but it's worth it with the idea that it's causing a feeling of accomplishment or something novel and interesting. That is the, you know, the obviously the positive aspect of taking a risk and coming out the other end feeling like it's made my life more interesting.
Your mind is a trap. Your mind is a trap. Your mind is what traps you. You know, this is going to be part of the CD that you're going to receive if you make your donation to WBAI. The mind is a coward. For those who listen to it become utterly cowardly. The mind is not an adventurer, it's cautious. It takes every step with thinking and calculation until it is certain there is no risk. Until it has seen others taking the risk, until it has seen others taking the step, and there has been no danger. Hence, listening to the mind is the most disturbing phenomenon of growth. When everything is going good, the mind comes in and says, watch out. Because you listen to your mind's fears, you will stop living. The mind would keep you always the same, never taking risks. Newness is an enemy to the mind. Sameness is its friend. Here's the dilemma. To laugh is to risk appearing a fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out is to risk involvement. To expose feelings is to risk rejection. To place your dreams before the crowd is to risk ridicule. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To go forward in the face of overwhelming odds is to risk failure. But risks must be taken because the greatest hazard of life is to stop taking risks. If you risk nothing, you are in a hazard. The person who risks nothing, does nothing, has nothing, is nothing. You may avoid suffering and sorrow, but you cannot learn, feel, change, grow, or love. Chained by certitudes, you're only a slave, because only the person who still risks is free. Kent, you're not just a believer in the give me a drug and get out of here.
No, I'm a big believer of fundamental change, and only change can occur with making different decisions and choices that usually come from psychotherapy or interventions that are other than just brain chemistry. So that, yes, brain chemistry has only a small part in what I think we have to offer in terms of making people change their lives for the better.
Yeah, and it's all about managing risk. Managing risk and managing their risks and the risks a person takes, some of which are right and some of which are just plain wacky. And you need to have somebody who could look at you that you love who says, honey, that's wacky. You know, but they don't have to judge you. They don't have to say to you, you're wrong, you're bad. But they just say, That's wacky. I'm going to go out and I'm going to adopt a child, even though I can't afford to pay the rent. Hey, sis, that's wacky. You know what I mean? Let's get you. Well, that's what therapy really is. Real therapy is finding a friend who could tell you you're wacky when you're being wacky and not judge you at the same time, too. Let me ask you a question, Linda Vanilla. Has your life been about risk?
Yes. Yes, and wonderfully so. I just wanted to mention that as we get older, the risks change significantly. As, for example, as an elder who could just run up and down stairs all of her life, now all of a sudden she's somewhat limited physically, so just going up a flight of stairs could be a risk. So I think that it's the spirit of looking at your life and saying, how can I advance? How can I move forward?
You're having trouble on the stairs?
Yes. Yeah.
I was talking to you, Linda. Linda.
No, I'm not having trouble
on the
stairs.
Okay, but there are risks that you take less of.
Yes.
You're more cautious.
Yes, I am.
Because you don't trust your reacting time. You don't trust yourself a little more, right?
On one level? Yes. Yes, most definitely. And I think more about when I'm traveling and if I'm in danger or if I think I'm in danger, whereas perhaps when I was younger, I relied more upon my strength, my courage.
How about spending money?
Oh, spending money. That gets wonderfully easy as we grow older.
I know spending it, but how about making sure you have it to spend?
Sure, of course. Yes. Well, of course, because you don't have the potential for making more.
Because what kids do, what people do is they spend ahead.
Sure.
Credit cards, buying houses they can't afford. This is the idea they call a risk. They think it's a risk, but it's crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they become slaves forever. Hey, thank you very much, Linda.
Welcome.
Thank you, Kent. Thank you. We are going to leave you now, but waiting to hear you go to your phones and get those things ringing because, geez, we deserve it.